another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream.
Hi, this is Jack Spirko with yet another edition of the Survival Podcast. Playing a little bit of catch up today because I missed a day of podcasting. Sometimes things are a little difficult. I don't necessarily always have my drives to myself, and I had to spend quite a bit of phone time the last couple trips, so I didn't miss a day. And therefore, some of the material I have today may be a day old. I don't think it's really going to matter because we're always looking to the future here. Today I am going to talk about some financial things that I see going on, some indicators I see in the market, and just the general vibe that I'm getting. Please always remember, whenever I do that, it is not financial advice. I am not a qualified investment advisor. And with all things, remember always that my podcast is one man's opinion, not the gospel of Jack Spirko. This is just my opinion and my views. That's what we get together to share every day. And just to talk about the things that, I mean, other people aren't talking about from a perspective that no one else is talking about. You can't get this type of conversation on talk radio. I looked for someone doing it, couldn't find anybody, so figured I'd do it myself. So this is really how this podcast came together. Before I get into some of these things today, though, I want to say thank you to my listeners. I set a goal to hit 100 listeners as quickly as possible. I've been doing this about right at 2 weeks, a little bit longer, maybe 2.5 weeks. If you count my first couple things where I was just trying to actually get the site up and learn how the WordPress, PodPress extension worked, which is fabulous, by the way. And we are already well over 100 listeners as of this morning. So thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm going to put out a 1,000 listener challenge later this week and see if I can figure out some way to give you guys an incentive to help me grow it and to 1,000 and maybe give away something cool to one listener. So look for that in a future podcast. So today, what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about a couple things today. One, I want to talk about this whole prop up of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and what it means and what hasn't happened and what I was wrong about. And again, remember, so I'm saying these are my opinions and my views, not the qualified advice of an investment professional. So here we go. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, as we discussed earlier this week, Fed came in and said, hey, I'm going to give you a bunch of money. We're going to prop you guys up with trillions of dollars if we have to. We'll buy some stock in you. We're going to do whatever it takes. We're not going to let these two guys go down. And I thought that would rebound their stocks a little bit, just a little bit anyway. And it did rebound it for about like 15 seconds. As of yesterday, we had a 22% drop in Freddie Mac, 18% drop in Fannie Mae. Didn't check them today. They may be down. They may be up. I'm not sure. But my point was that short-term bounce did not come. I see that as good news. I see that as bad news. The reason I see it as good news is because it means that the American investor is becoming less stupid. They're not immediately going, oh, it's going to be wonderful now, Google thing, because I told you I didn't think that long-term these were good strategies for these companies. I just thought the American, the boobus Americanists out there would just bite like they always seem to when someone steps in and bails these things. Because unlike Bear Stearns, they didn't wait till it crashed all the way out of the bottom. They kind of caught it on the way down and prevented the harsh slam to the floor. So I thought that would suck her money back in. It hasn't yet. So if you're thinking that Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae are good buys right now, you may want to talk to your advisor about holding off, because I don't know that we're going to not see them come down quite a bit more before it's over with. Another interesting thing that happened in the day that I missed doing the show. I actually went and talked to a new potential financial advisor for myself, and I told him that my goal for the next 18 to 24 months is capital preservation, that I'm looking to preserve my capital right now, to hedge in ways, and I don't mean hedge funds, I mean hedge with gold, hedge with solid investments, hedge with some foreign currencies, and go to capital preservation, and when he could tell me when there were strong indicators of a rebound, I'd be happy to start putting some more money back into the more conventional investments. But just his gut was not enough, and he told me that he believed we were about 85% through this downturn. When I pressed him a little harder as to what made him think that, it ended up being his gut, his instinct. You might think I would have walked out on him. No, I actually stayed, and we've got to put some recommendations together for me, because I respect the hell out of the fact that he was able to admit that instead of trying to trump up facts and figures behind it that don't exist. So I told him, preserve my wealth for the next year and a half to 2 years, and we'll look for singular opportunity investments along the way. He was open to that, so we'll see what he comes back with, and I'll make my decision based on what he recommends and how well he actually listens to my needs and my goals. So that is advice, okay? That when you're talking to your financial advisor, make damn sure you're clear about what you want, and make damn sure that he's working towards your goals, not toward his training. Because even with that, even with the sincerity and the honesty we had going back and forth, he was, you know, trying to talk me off the ledge, so to speak, with bailing on any of my investments that are still in any kind of conventional mutual fund. Because, you know, with the darkest before the dawn theory, there's always the down market goes up, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I had to be very clear, hey, man, I understand all of that. I think it's different this time. If I'm wrong, I can live with losing some of the upside. If I'm right and I don't protect what I have, I can't live with losing it on the downside when everything told me it was coming. So there's, you know, just when you're talking to investment people, make sure that you're bringing knowledge to the table, you're bringing desire to the table, you're bringing your own goals to the table. That's important. And financial planning is a huge part of survival planning today. Because the reality on the ground is, there's always a place for having some wealth. And if you have some wealth, you always have options and people without it don't. So preserve, build, and protect. That's my philosophy. It's like a sandwich. Preserve your wealth that you already have. Alright? Build more wealth, and then surround it with more protection on the other side. Keeping what you have is more important than what you could have if everything goes right. Always remember that. That's my opinion, but it's something that I believe in wholeheartedly. The reason I talked about all this is because then this guy took me into a piece of advice that I'm not ready to act on yet. He looked at the financial sector, and he seems to see Bank of America as kind of a bright spot in the financial sector right now. So, you know, I decided to start looking at the Bank of America, and one thing I'll give the guy credibility for, it seems like a lot of analysts and a lot of investors are looking at BOA and saying, you know, these guys seem like they've weathered the storm fairly well. They weathered it enough that they were able to buy out Countrywide. The biggest exposure they have is in that buyout, but they let Countrywide take the biggest beating. BOA wasn't deep into the subprime mess. They kind of divested the mess that Countrywide made by it took what was left, which was useful to them. And things seem to be pretty good for Bank of America. They seem to be stable. They seem to still be making money. They're still paying out a quite sizable income, and they have a good price-to-earnings ratio. Sounds great. Looked into it. Everything he told me is true. Okay? And the stock price that they have versus a dividend is very good. A dividend right now, the last dividend paid out about 12% of your investment. That's a hell of a dividend. So am I interested in possibly going into that stock? Possibly. But here's the deal. I decided, well, let's look at the trend of Bank of America. What's going on with them right now? The first thing that I was able to determine between the end of the last fiscal year and the last quarterly report that came out early this year, their cash on hand declined by $2 billion. All right? Now, that's not necessarily bad, and they did buy out of a major financial institution, and the money had to come from somewhere, and they didn't go into debt to do it. So they spent money, but when you have a cash decline, that's something you have to be considerate of. Now, the next thing I did is I looked at what was their net profit in their fiscal year 06 ending report was 16% net profit. In 2008, their net profit quarterly at the end of the first quarter 08, 7.12%. So it's a very, very much a dried up net profit. Their operating margin in the same period of time went from a 22% operating margin to a 10% operating margin. And their net income went from $21 billion down to $1.2 billion a quarter, or about $4.8 billion a year. So they went from a $21 billion a year income to a $5 billion in income. So, I mean, this is the type of research that you would think that, well, you know, you have to be smart to figure this stuff out. All I did was go to Google Finance and just look at the figures and statistics and just look at key indicators like how much money they have, how much money they're earning, what their profit margins are, and what trend those things are on regardless of what the stock price is. So what we've seen is a decline in cash, a decline in margin, and a decline in profit. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean this is a bad stock to go into, but, hey, look, they have an earnings report that's due out on July 21st. And the reason that I talked about this for so long today is just because I realized that if I went and talked to a financial advisor with concerns about my portfolio and protecting it, some of my listeners out there might be doing the same thing. And that when you do that, you might have somebody throw a stock at you and explain to you why it's a good buy. Financial sector, they're one of the companies that are still making money. Their stock's been driven down by guilt by association and paying a solid dividend. Everything's true, but checking the other side, you know, and finding out, hey, a major earnings report's going to come out, and it's either going to tank this stock or prop it up a little bit. It's not going to take off overnight, so, you know, let's wait and see what that earnings report has to say. Is it going to be a further decline? Are they going to be losing money? I mean, what are we going to see out of that report? That's going to be very interesting. And remember, these reports, they're giving us the late information. They already have this information. All of these companies are trying to put the right public spin on it before they release it. So since I know that's coming, you know, I'll just kind of hold off. And my, you know, that's kind of just my opinion, that when somebody throws an investment idea at you, don't ever think that you got to jump on it right now. Like, do a little research, get a little information, and figure out if something's going to come out that's going to give you a better indication. You may not make as much upside, but you sure as hell will hedge your downside. And remember, my belief with your wealth is, you know, preserve, build, protect. And that's, I believe that with everything you have. With your assets, your home, your homestead, your lifestyle, your job, your relationships, preserve, build, protect. In that order, with those priorities being that way. So hopefully that gives you just a little bit of things to think about. And I want to, like, kind of right now, I want to go into answering a few questions that I've gotten since I started doing the podcast by email, or even a couple of them came in the comments. So one came in yesterday from a guy named Black Mac X, is how he signs his name on my comments on the blog for the podcast. And he said, you know, he'd be interested in hearing what my energy setup is like at my house. As I mentioned before, I actually have two homes. And one is kind of a little place up in the Arkansas mountains that I get up to about once a month, that I'm slowly developing into a homestead that eventually I want to move to. And so that one I haven't done a whole lot with, because we only use energy there one or two days out of any given month. So we've done the basic things, which is making sure that the place is insulated properly, making sure that when we leave we don't have the air conditioner running while we leave for 28 days before we return, and things like that. We have neighbors looking out for it for us. We have put up a gate to keep people out. That doesn't really help with energy, but it does help with security of the place. And so that's kind of an in-the-future plan up there. Because of that, because my plan is a relatively short-term plan, if I'm still in this area 4 years from now, I may have to eat the end of a Colt 45 or something, because I really want to get out of the city life, at least on a day-to-day basis, relatively short-term, certainly before my 40th birthday. So what that's meant for me is I've been very judicious with what I've actually invested money-wise into my home here in Dallas-Fort Worth. As you know, I don't believe that we're in for a short-term recession, or I think we're in for a long-term recession, and I'm only comfortable putting so much money into my home with the intent of selling it in the next 2 to 4 years, or maybe even a year if I can talk the wife into it at some point. So I've done the things that are easy that make the most sense to reduce consumption rather than increase energy production. And what I mean by that are the simple things. Compact fluorescent light bulbs, they cut maybe 10% of our electric bill the first month that we actually did it. We've increased the insulation in the home. I am going to do the black hose on the roof to make hot water thing. In fact, I'm working on it right now, but my wife and I have decided collectively together that I'm okay at putting the stuff up on the roof and running the lines down to the hot water heater and all. But when it comes time to actually disconnect the service, reconnect it, and make sure nothing leaks and everything's done properly, then we're going to have a handyman come out and do it. We just don't trust me to get that done right and not have any problems. So I don't have a big photovoltaic system at my house in Texas or anything. I am, like I said, really interested in seeing if I can find somebody that knows what they're doing to do one of the simple photovoltaic systems that are used, like used panels or whatever, that make a dent in the electrical bill. If I can keep the cost down, I would definitely be open to doing something like that. My major plans for investing in energy production stuff, either wind or solar or some combination, are for Arkansas once I'm out of here, because I plan on being there for possibly the rest of my life. So that's where I'm going to make my my bigger investment. So yeah, I kind of try to live the plan that I preach, and one of the biggest things I preach is, hey, have a secondary location. Eventually get yourself out of these cities. With telecommuting today, many professionals, if the economy stays steady, you know, you're going to be able to figure out how to work from home and make the same kind of money you could in the city, but live out in the country. So that's, you know, why live in congestion and traffic and everything else if you don't have to? I think eventually you're going to have the option not to. So that's part of why I said. But the other thing is that these cities are getting so greedy with the property taxes. I mean, I figured out that if I were to pay my mortgage in full at my home in Arlington, I would still be paying in property tax about what I was paying in rent in 1993. All right? So the only way for me to escape that is to move out into a rural, unincorporated area where they don't have these ridiculously high property taxes. That's another, you know, just a long-term survival tactic of preserving wealth. So, you know, those are some things that I've done, and those are some of the rationale behind them. Another question I got was, you know, I have a strong libertarian bent to my political side, and on this Fannie Mae Freddie Mac thing, obviously I don't think the Fed dumping money into this thing is a good idea. But the other side of it is they're holding, you know, half the mortgages in the United States, and the reality is they're not holding them, because a lot of times they dump them, but they're holding a lot of mortgages. They are a source for the American home buyer. They are the way that most people get their first home. So what's my solution if it's not to prop them up? First of all, let me say, I have always said the government is always busy actively trying to solve problems that it created in the first place. We have to ask ourselves a question. Should Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae have been created in their current forms, subsidized and backed by the government in the first place? To me, the answer is no. I don't believe that everybody needs to have a house, that everybody should have a house. I think everybody should work towards a house, but there's a given level of sacrifice that needs to be made so that you can get to the point where you can actually have a house. That sacrifice, for a long time, kept real estate prices in check. It kept them from running away. It kept them from, it actually kept homes from becoming unattainable for a lot of people. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, short-term, have increased the number of people that can buy a home. Long-term, they've had the exact opposite effect, because they've artificially inflated real estate prices because they've allowed people to borrow more money than they should be able to. They've allowed people to go with too little equity and too little savings. They have not yet developed a financially responsible behavior pattern. And that's allowed money to pour into the real estate market that never would have before. Due to that fact, the price of property gets pushed up because there's more buyers. All right? That's what happened. That's why real estate prices fell, because they got pushed up too high in the first place. Now, there's certain markets where there's always been real estate bubbles. The West Coast market, for instance, property always seems to inflate and deflate out there, right? But it's self-correcting. Now we have these bubbles all over the United States, with very few exceptions. We're not seeing, you know, where we're not seeing real estate slide, and then most of that's being propped up by regional impacts, such as my area, again, the Barnett Shale, huge natural gas reserves all over Dallas-Fort Worth. Just about every home here has natural gas under it, and neighborhood associations are getting together, negotiating leases, and people that live here are getting paid really substantial sums of money just so the gas company can extract the natural gas. So don't let them tell you you're running out of fossil fuels, folks, because there's so much natural gas here that it's creating a boom for just about every homeowner. All right? But on the, you know, in the real world, not everybody ends up with natural gas reserves under their house. And even that's a short-term thing. We got a nice check for the initial bonus, and then when they start pumping gas, we might get a couple $100 a month for 3 or 4 years. That's nice, but 3 or 4 years later, it's gone. And that's something that we have to understand. I mean, these original boosts are always short-term. What stabilizes property is very simple. When property gets to be too expensive, people stop buying it. So people that are selling property have to lower the price. This keeps the value of property in check. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae have pushed property and subprime on top of it, and all these creative lending programs and 40-year mortgages and 50-year mortgages and interest-only loans. Let's just keep increasing the buying power of the individual, regardless of how big we slam them with debt consequences. what do you think is going to happen? Of course, property values getting pushed up, up, up. It all seems great until you want to sell your house and property has come back down and you've paid entirely too much for it. Contrary to popular belief, real estate does not always go up in value, nor should it always go up in value. It should have a sustained growth over time, but not year to year, every year, all the time, because eventually we're going to get to a point where real estate runs away so much that the average person can no longer afford a home, and we've gotten there in some areas. So my solution is let the damn thing come down. Let it crash. Let it correct itself. One of the things I've heard suggested by a guy named Steve Forbes, who ran for president in the past, and frankly, I wish he was running now because, you know, he's a solid guy, and I think he could help the economy at least, was to break them up into smaller entities. They've gotten too big, they've got too much power, they've got too much control. Yeah, I'm for breaking them up, but only if we completely privatize them as well. I think this government 20% backing of mortgages has got to go away. It's going to cost us a fortune one way or another. We can't just abandon it and let it go. It's because something has to be done because it's a complete destruction of the economy if it's this full out of slide. That breakup plan with privatization and weaning off of the current system that the government screwed up in the first place, that has some real merit, and it's something I think that really should be looked into. Okay, and in spite of the fact that I podcast in the morning, occasionally I do turn the radio on and listen to talk radio. And I actually did listen to Glenn Beck the other day, who I really like, actually yesterday. And he stated something that I found very, very interesting. As bad as gas prices appear in the United States right now, they actually should be higher. And not this liberal, well, you know, France pays, and Belgium pays, and Denmark pays. Hey, no offense to the people that live there, but part of why I don't want to live there is I don't want to pay $9 a gallon for gas, even though I might have to. But if I ever pay $9, they're going to be paying $18. So that's part of why I don't live there. So that message doesn't hold water with me. What Glenn was saying is that the oil companies have kept gas prices down because they've had to, because they know they're going to have an all-out revolt. And they've passed the buck. And they've done it by passing the buck to the airlines. In other words, the airlines got to buy fuel. They got to buy Jet A fuel, right? So what they've done is they've gone out and they've increased the cost of Jet A fuel to the airlines to subsidize a decreasing cost of gasoline to the consumer. I know when we're paying $4 plus a gallon, and my buddy Ben Fitz up in Connecticut told me some prices they're paying, you know, $4.20 or more in Connecticut, get up to over $5 for diesel. And you go, how the hell can we be paying less? But we are. We are paying less because of this. Now, it's not a huge amount of money to the individual, but as a whole, it's a massive amount of money. But here's the reality. What have the airlines done in response to this? The airlines are a business. They won't just keep burning fuel. First thing they did is they started jacking up rates or charging for things they hadn't charged in the past. Pass it on to consumer. Results? Less people fly. Less people fly, airlines cut routes. They don't like to fly empty planes. It costs them more money than it's worth to put a plane in the air without enough passengers on it. So what happens then? The consumption of fuel by the airlines has declined. All right. Smart airlines like Southwest have bought futures on their fuel and are still paying the old price, so they're not paying more. So overall, the airline industry has curtailed their cost. What does this mean? It means your gas is going to go up again. That's what it means. You know, Glenn made a case for it. I can't argue the case. It makes perfect sense that as soon as the gasoline is not profitable, the total fuel is starts to lose its profitability, they have to transfer it back over to the people in cars. And that's what we're going to see happening, and we're already starting to see a little bit of it. So right now, your overly priced fuel is still somewhat subsidized by the government. Or not by the government, I'm sorry, by the oil companies themselves, by passing the buck to, you know, one of their largest customers. Now, another interesting thing that I picked up about this whole gas mess recently is this morning they had some talking heads whatever Matt Lauer, whatever show he does, happened to be the one that ended up on the TV this morning, and they brought in three experts to discuss how to fix the economy. One was some lady I never heard of before, and I'm sorry, I can't remember her name now. The other one was Steve Forbes. who made the suggestion of breaking up Freddie Mac. And the third one was my buddy and yours, Jim Cramer. Jim by Bear Stearns Cramer, you know, who I made some opinions clear about earlier this week. Well, Jim actually had one really good suggestion for fixing the economy. I mean, so good that I might put this jerk in charge of the economy for a while because it was so good. And it was kill ethanol. Kill ethanol in its place. You want to put a mandate on something, mandate that we start using more natural gas. We have natural gas, and we do have it here in Texas. We have it all over the place. Massive amounts of natural gas. Incentivize, automakers to start making more natural gas usable vehicles. Start using it for more power generation purposes, etc. Natural gas, wave into the future, according to Jim Cramer. Now, look, guys, I am not, as you know, I don't believe in the big evil carbon footprint, but I think we need to get off the fossil fuels, but we need a stopgap measure. To me, it is make sensible use of what we have. And Cramer's right, man. Natural gas is an abundant resource. Let's use it right now. I'm also a big fan of using nuclear power. And I'm going to actually talk about some questions I had about that as well here in just a second. And actually something that I kind of misspoke about on an earlier podcast, so I want to correct that. But nuclear power combined with using effective things like natural gas burns very, very clean. It does produce carbon, but it doesn't produce the waste that's like coal does. All right, and it's easier to extract, and we have a ton of it. So, to me, if we're going to get to a point where we use wind and solar heavily, then first thing we do is stop the bleeding. And the bleeding's all about oil right here. And now we have, you know, food for oil with ethanol, and those two things together are just taking up all the resources that could be invested in true clean energy. So you take what works. Electrical facilities today can start burning natural gas at once. We can build safe nuclear power plants today at once. We know how to do it. The Germans do it. The French do it. The Germans have gotten to a point where they're producing 15% of their national energy consumption with wind and solar and other truly green energy. But you know how they did it? They did it because they built the shit out of nuclear power plants first. They gave themselves a surplus of energy, and they used that surplus of energy to develop other technologies. That makes sense. Nuclear and natural gas should be a migration path. Jim Cramer coming out and saying, kill ethanol. Hey, you know what? Jim, I'm going to give you kudos on that one. You're absolutely right. We need to kill ethanol production. All it's doing is jacking prices up. And as Mr. Cramer put it, his program would cut food prices by about 40% in just a few months. He's dead on. He's right. Way to go, Jim. I'm glad you got one like that. Next on nuclear power, a question I got and an answer to two sides of the question. The first thing is that I stated that, you know, you basically pulled uranium and tritium and plutonium out of the ground. We use it, it gets depleted, and then we bury it back in the ground from whence it came. That's overly simplified, and it's not exactly accurate. The waste, the high-yield waste that we produce from nuclear power plants is not the same as it was when it came out of the ground. It's much more dangerous. The reason it is much more dangerous, though, isn't because the reactor makes it more dangerous. It's before it goes in the reactor. When we mine uranium or tritium or plutonium, it's in its raw ore form. Before we use it for power, we refine it and we increase its potency. We increase its concentration. So the high-level waste that comes from nuclear power plants is highly concentrated and therefore more dangerous. It's still very small compared to the amount of energy produced, and we can still store all our high-level waste from power generation in one high school gymnasium. And if you bury that stuff deep enough in the ground and surround it with concrete, it's as safe as anything out there. It's definitely more safe than the ash from a cogeneration plant. But I did get called on that statement because of the way it came out. It wasn't accurate the way that it should be. And I want to try to be as accurate as I can. And as I told this individual by email, this is also this Black Mac X guy who's really helping me out here with his suggestions for improvement. That, you know, he's dead on about the way that sounded. So I do want to point that out. I still think it's a safe alternative, and it is a good stopgap measure. The next part about that, though, was he said that he didn't think it was a good solution because we don't have much uranium. that we don't have enough reserves to go for very long as a solution. Well, the reality is that's a lie. And that's not a lie from him. That's a lie that he's been told and believed by these environmentalist whack jobs that are out on the fringes like Greenpeace. There is more uranium in the ground right now than there is tin in the ground right now. Right? There's uranium is far more plentiful than gold. We haven't done any real exploration for uranium in over 20 years. It's out there. There's a substance called tritium that can actually be converted to uranium, and there's more of that than there is uranium. We have enough nuclear reserves known that if we do things the right way, we reuse fuel, we go through second pass through reactors, which this guy also suggested and he's dead on about, that we could power the world's energy needs for 400 years. Now, they said, I don't want to do that. I don't want 400 years of nuclear power. But I think that 50 to 100 years of nuclear power with a design and a process and a plan to get us onto true green energy sources is a hell of a solution to the fossil fuel nightmare debacle that we have with being 100% dependent on oil. So that kind of wraps up the podcast today. I just kind of, I guess, went through and did another recap of a bunch of other things, and hope I'm being able to keep this entertaining. And guys, I'm still getting a handle on this this 80-mile-an-hour podcasting thing on the interstate and the turnpikes. So please bear with me as I do that. I'm trying to improve it every day. I do have some interesting subjects planned in the future, and tune in later this week to hear about how maybe I can incentivize you guys to help me grow the podcast even faster. And remember always, I want your suggestions. I want your input. If you think there's something that I should do a show on, tell me about it. Let me know. If there's some subject that I talk about, is it something you're really interested in, tell me that too. And if enough people aren't interested in a particular subject, I'm not going to talk about it, because this is not, again, this is not the gospel of Jack. This is one man's view. In a way that lets other people think and interact and share. That's what the show's all about, helping you provide yourself with the ability to live a really good life, whether times get tough or even if they don't.
You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.